Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first three meals free.
This is The Takeaway for Thursday, December 8th, 2016.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. We're so glad you could attend. Come inside, come inside.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening to A Summer Goodbye all this hour. Greg Lake. We'll be hearing his music. He died of cancer at the age of 69. He was of Emerson, Lake & Palmer and the band King Crimson. And since we are the show that's on all the time, what does it take to govern a country? Ever thought about that? We never stop thinking about it. The ingredients? You need the power to collect taxes. You need the power to enforce laws. That's police power, most of all. And really, the basis of all that is a belief in the system itself. From people's faith in the system, that their money is valuable, that one vote is counted in a free and fair election, to the faith that police are enforcing laws equally. All of that is eroded when things happen like Hillary Clinton's winning the popular vote on November 8th, a count that currently stands at 2.7 million. It also happened back in 2000. Al Gore lost to George W. Bush, even though he won the popular vote by little more than 540,000 votes. Perhaps nothing shows a lack of mandate, though, or an eroding faith in the system nationally better than when you look at the huge number of people who didn't vote at all. Does Donald Trump have a mandate to govern? Can anyone in this environment? Would changing the Electoral College help this? Who is representing the millions more who voted for Hillary? Is there a point where a country, this country, becomes ungovernable? Wakefield, Massachusetts gave us one of the revolutionary suggestions we've been soliciting from you all week. We should have a national civic app for voter registration, voting, jury duty, etc. It would revolutionize civic life with accessibility.
My name's Paul. I'm calling from Portland, Oregon. We instituted auto voter enrollment here and also have been voting by mail for years. Both systems seem to work really well, and I would like to see them rolled out nationally. Beyond that, you could impose national mandatory vote, as is done in Australia.
Newton Minow is an American attorney. He's vice chair of the Commission on Presidential Debates. He's a former chair of the Federal Communications Commission. And here's what President Obama said about Newton Minow at the ceremony last month.
Public interest. That's been the heartbeat of his life's work. Advocating for residents of public housing, advising a governor and a Supreme Court justice, cementing presidential debates as our national institution, leading the FCC.
The president also revealed that Minow happened to be present for President Obama's and First Lady Michelle Obama's first date. They went out to a movie, none of that staying home and watching the wasteland of television with Newt Minow around. More on that later. But first, Newt Minow says there's a great deal of work to be done in America. When millions of people don't vote, millions more can't find a candidate that's likable, and we now have millions who voted for a winner who was not ultimately deemed a winner. A candidate upgrade is what he would institute first.
I am very critical of our system of primaries. If you added up all the votes that both Mr. Trump and Hillary Clinton got in the primaries, all the votes, they would amount to less than 10% of the American eligible voters, less than 10%. And you ended up with an election in which the majority of the American voters said, we don't like either candidate. Many of people voted against rather than for. And so we really have, if you believe in democracy, you should find, we've got to find ways for more people to participate in the democratic process.
At what point, though, does America become ungovernable?
Well, I think the Congress has become ungovernable in the last 10 years or so. I blame the primary system. I blame too much money in politics. I blame, and to some extent, the media for fostering and emphasizing conflict rather than those who are in the center who want to make compromises. So it's a lot of factors involved, but certainly it's not a very satisfactory system at the moment.
If we were to go back and seriously address the question of the Electoral College, is it the case, as you view the law, that the Electoral College has evolved away from this kind of landowners-only club into a system which a lot of people in rural America think was supposed to protect their vote so that they wouldn't get overwhelmed by the cities? Is that the reason we think we have the Electoral College today versus what it was originally intended for?
The Electoral College was a compromise in the beginning to protect the smaller states, and also some scholars believe to protect slavery. It was a way to bring disparate views of the different 13 states in the beginning to reach a compromise. Today, I believe if we were starting all over again, we wouldn't have the Electoral College, because we would count the national vote as determinative rather than the votes of a certain number of states. And if we're going to have a national election, we should not have the system of an Electoral College. And this is the second time in a few elections where the majority of the people voted for the candidate who lost the presidency.
So do we want to preserve that illusion that the Electoral College gives, that rural votes are important, and we wouldn't want to lose that if we get rid of the Electoral College?
No, we want to keep everybody. We believe that everybody should have an equal vote, and that people in the smaller states, particularly in the western states, should not have more votes than those people who live in the big states.
But would that argue for doing something like after a particular number in California and New York and Texas, the big population states, or Florida, that you stop counting at a certain point, that above a certain level you don't count anymore, that which would preserve some sense of the importance of places like West Virginia and New Hampshire and New Mexico?
Well, what happens now is that candidates don't even campaign nationally. Their managers who study the numbers say you go to this state, don't go to that state. You pick a few states that are called battleground states where the campaigns exist, and ignore the rest of the country, which is not treating people equally.
So we've created a system that's going to give us this result again and again and again, it sounds like you're saying.
Well, what I've been reading lately, because there's now been a good deal of publicity and analysis, is that Alexander Hamilton in The Federalists really argued the case for the Electoral College, and I understand was really in some ways an anti-democratic argument. As the country has grown and is now a country of 320 million people spread out over thousands and thousands of miles, we've got to find a different way. But I go back also to the primary system, we've got to find a way to have more people participate in choosing the candidates as well as voting in the general election.
So would you say that among the things to do tomorrow to bring more people into the process would be scrap the primary process and eliminate the Electoral College?
The problem is nobody can figure out a better alternative than the primary process, at least not so far. I've even thought that perhaps we need three parties, not two, that we need one party on the right, one party on the left, and one party in the center. And I think that the parties have to rethink their basic principles because the differences have become so severe.
You've suggested that the Congress right now is already ungovernable. Certainly the House is by virtue of the redistricting process, is presumed to be Republican unless things radically change in the United States. Based on the demographics of the United States, it's easier to get a Democratic majority in the Senate than it is to get a Republican majority in the Senate. And now you've got the Supreme Court, which has moved from a nonpartisan, you know, legal think tank, shall we say, arbiter of issues, to being this 5-4 divided court on liberal conservative, how worried are you that we are creating partisan institutions, not a shared set of institutions to come together and to exercise mandates and a sort of shared vision of the future?
Well, this is where I think the press has a job to do in the next few years of getting these issues, these questions that you're raising with me, getting them debated and thought about and analyzed throughout the country. We're in the 21st century, and we're dealing with a bunch of concepts which no longer seem to fit the needs of the people.
Newton Minow, you wrote in an absolutely irresistible piece about witnessing the Obama's first date. You showed up at a movie theater in Chicago, and summer intern Barack Obama was taking Michelle Robinson out for their first date. You remember the movie you went to see?
The movie was Spike Lee's movie, Do the Right Thing. My wife, Jo, and I loved the movies, and we went to a neighborhood theater. To our surprise, at the popcorn stand, there were Barack and Michelle. And because Michelle was Barack's supervisor, she was very embarrassed. She felt she shouldn't be dating somebody who was she was in charge of in the office. And I could see she was concerned about it. So I said, forget it. Enjoy the evening. Have a good time. And the other day when I got the Medal of Freedom, when I walked in and saw Michelle, she ran over and gave me a hug, and she pointed to the president, and she said, see what you got me into? I did the right thing by getting them together.
Absolutely. Newton Minow, thank you so much.
Thank you, John, and good luck to you with your continue doing what you're doing.
Thanks so much. Some more Donald Trump nominations for his cabinet. Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt is President-elect Donald Trump's pick to head the EPA. And another general has been nominated to serve in the cabinet. Retired Marine General John Kelly will serve as the head of the Department of Homeland Security if he is confirmed by the Senate. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, joins me now. So Kelly, I mean, in some ways I always thought of the Department of Homeland Security as the real Department of Defense. I mean, that's what defense is, defending the homeland. But it encompasses a whole lot of jobs that could end up making Kelly look far more controversial than he is.
Well, John, I mean, it is a Department of Defense in some ways when you look at the borders. But don't forget that Homeland Security also has a huge amount of domestic internal security functions, TSA, airline safety, immigration, naturalization, Secret Service, a lot of stuff like that. So it's a way bigger job than just enforcing the borders from the outside. John Kelly's a retired Marine four-star. He used to lead SOCOM, the Southern Command, down in Florida with responsibilities for the Caribbean, for Latin America, South America, which is a job that's described as really projecting America's soft power. You know, they're not driving a lot of ships up to coastlines and bombing installations like that. Kelly has been really active on the scene, though, describing international drug trafficking cartels and human trafficking as national security threats to the United States. He's been very hawkish about that, about the threat of terrorist organizations using human trafficking or immigration to possibly infiltrate the United States. So Donald Trump may like Kelly's attitude in that way, given Trump's position on immigration, but people don't know too much about John Kelly's position on those domestic immigration policies like deportation, like detention, some of those things that Donald Trump promised on the campaign trail, cracking down on criminal illegal aliens and stuff like that. John Kelly's not the guy who has a long track record on that.
And Pruitt is about the hardest stick in the eye for the environmentalists in terms of running the EPA. Is his views compatible with even the existence of the EPA?
Yet not really, because Scott Pruitt has a career as a lawyer and attorney general in Oklahoma, where he not only questioned climate science, clean air regulations, the Clean Power Plan, but really the entire function of the EPA as a bureaucracy and its right to regulate environmental causes, basically thinks that's a state function, has been in close league with fossil fuel industry, coal and gas, and oil industry throughout his career, was found by the New York Times, John Pentagon in 2014 to have used letters drafted by coal and gas lobbyists as he was fighting the EPA on regulations, using letters drafted for him by lobbyists. You say stick in the eye. Let me play you Hawaii Senator Democrat Brian Schatz, who I spoke to yesterday about the prospect of Scott Pruitt at the EPA.
This is not a close call. This is not your run-of-the-mill Republican administrator. This is a person who denies the basic science, who denies that this is a real problem at all. And so to have a person such as this running the EPA is totally unacceptable.
Ouch.
Yeah, John, Democrats are absolutely beside themselves over the idea of Scott Pruitt at the EPA. They basically say he has a track record not only of climate denial, but wanting to dismantle the entire organization. A lot of Republicans, at least ones I talked to, are thrilled. You know who you want to hear from here is Jim Inhofe, the Republican senator from Oklahoma, chairman of the Environment Committee. Oklahoma, I said, he's a close confidant of Scott Pruitt's here. Guys, play EPA 3.
We know his position. It is one that the world isn't coming to an end tomorrow because of man-made gases. He's one of my closest personal friends, and I flew him around the state his first race in my plane, places where my numbers were good. And so I've been working with him really closely for a long time.
Now, that's both spin and code words. He doesn't believe that the world is coming to an end because of human-supplied gases. Now, environmentalists would say, no, that's not what Pruitt thinks at all. It's that he doesn't think there is any climate change to begin with. The science doesn't suggest it's coming, and so it's the environmentalists who are the end of the worlders.
Well, I think the greater concern, if you parse the language, not only is what Inhofe thinks, who has called climate change a hoax, but what Donald Trump thinks, who has also called climate change a hoax crafted by the Chinese to dismantle the American economy. Now, Trump has made other comments to the New York Times that he thinks there's some connection between human activity and climate change. But this appointment of Scott Pruitt is going to change people's minds about where Donald Trump really is on the issue. And this one could be close, John, in the Senate. Now, of course, remember, Republicans, if they stick to the party line, have the votes to approve any nominee, including Scott Pruitt, because the filibuster on executive nominations, Harry Reid did away with it in the Senate when Barack Obama was president. So Democrats by themselves can't stop somebody like Scott Pruitt. However, senators like Brian Schatz and others who are absolutely incensed by this nomination say they're going straight to Republicans who are on the record stating that climate change is a real thing that needs to be fixed. People like Susan Collins of Maine and others, and plan to bring those people out and force them to take a position. They think it's early. They think they may be able to defeat this nomination, even with the 51 votes that they would need to do it, because they can put pressure on some of those Republicans who don't want to vote with somebody who they're going to paint as a naked climate denier to head the EPA.
Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You got it, John.
This week, the Surgeon General Vivek Murthy announced that the escalated use of e-cigarettes among young people is a major public health concern, based on a report Murthy released earlier this week that stated that more research is needed on the health effects of e-cigs, but action must be taken on protecting grade school students and young adults from being harmed by nicotine products. Michael Erickson is the founding dean of the School of Public Health at Georgia State University and former director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Office on Smoking and Health. Welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
The CDC seems to view e-cigarettes not so much as a way of quitting smoking, a sort of health benefit of quitting smoking, but as a new kind of addiction to nicotine and a gateway drug for young people.
Well, it really depends on the age of the group that we're talking about. The Surgeon General's report focused on young people, and there's a certain set of issues there. What it didn't focus on is really the most important and controversial issue, which is about adult smokers.
And we learned that smokers are in the minority of people using tobacco products as a result of this latest data.
Yes. What we found surprising to everyone is that e-cigarettes are the most common form of tobacco product used by both middle school students and high school students. The issue, though, behind that is that some feel that e-cigarettes shouldn't be considered a tobacco product because they're less harmful. But they do contain nicotine, and that's what's driving the comparison between e-cigarettes and tobacco products, but also that's where the controversy lies.
I guess it's just as easy to obtain regular cigarettes, but somehow vaping has become cooler and has turned into something of a gateway for young people to addiction, I guess, to nicotine, and then who knows what else.
Right. I mean, again, it's a complex issue, but it's clear that vaping has become extremely popular with young people, that it's a combination of technology and coolness and marketing. If you look at some of these products, they look like Apple products. They're chrome, they have lights, they're just really cool. And they can be used not just for nicotine and tobacco products, but they can also be used for other drugs. So there's a number of reasons that these products, these devices, have become really popular with young people. The larger issue is nicotine and its effect on young people, whether it's better to do than smoking or whether it leads to smoking. And this report tried to address some of those issues.
Now, this feels a little bit like, you know, the horse is out of the barn and it's on fire. Why would the vaping industry be allowed to form in an unregulated environment if there was this concern on the part of the medical community that, you know, the growth of vaping would mean the growth of addiction and the growth of uses of other kinds of drugs with these vaping devices?
So in this instance, FDA did not have the authority to regulate e-cigarettes until August of 2016. And still, they do not have the authority to assure childproof caps on e-liquids, which can be toxic. And so Congress had to pass an act giving that authority to the Consumer Product Safety Commission, because it would have taken too long for FDA to have exerted its authority otherwise. So regulations and policies are not nimble sufficiently to respond to marketplace hazards or opportunities, depending upon how you view it. The net effect is that the Surgeon General felt that kids are at risk from nicotine exposure, and I would concur with that.
Michael Erickson is founding dean of the School of Public Health at Georgia State University and former director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Office on Smoking and Health. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
It seemed like he was dodging the question when he was asked about it during the campaign, but Donald Trump declared repeatedly and definitively that abortion, in his view, is a matter for states to decide, independent of the federal government. Well, the state of Ohio apparently heard that as an invitation. In a sneaky late-night session this week, the Ohio General Assembly passed what is, in effect, a total ban on abortions, if it is signed into law by Ohio Governor John Kasich. Jennifer Branch, attorney at Gerhardstein and Branch in Cincinnati. I don't get it. Isn't there a federally protected right for a woman to get an abortion?
Since 1973, the U.S. Constitution has protected a woman's right to have an abortion, and this law will completely gut that constitutional right.
And for a long time, anti-abortion groups have focused on the very end of the term as a way of getting regulations stiffened around the, you know, late-term abortion idea. This is a first attempt to really go at the very, very beginnings of the fetal life.
Ohio has been restricting a woman's right to have an abortion since the beginning. And usually it's been barriers put in their place and things that are done to shame the woman into having an abortion. They put these barriers up. You have to wait 24 hours before you can have an abortion. You have to look at our state-mandated materials. The anti-abortion people can stand on the sidewalk with signs and yell and scream at a woman. And then Ohio passed a different heartbeat bill, which was now a doctor has to do an ultrasound and show the woman the heartbeat on the ultrasound, let her hear the heartbeat if she wants to. All these things Ohio has done to shame them. Now this bill is to punish women because there is no exception. If a woman's life is at stake, and she needs to have an abortion, if a woman has
been raped... Well, let's hold on to that for a second, because there's a scenario that a lot of women are aware of and fear. It's relatively rare, but still significant. I mean, an ectopic pregnancy, you can hear a heartbeat of a fetus that has essentially implanted in a place in the woman's body where it cannot survive, and if it gets larger, can actually kill the woman.
It's unclear whether this bill would punish the doctor, which would be a felony and a prison sentence, a loss of a license, litigation, punish the woman because she can't have an abortion in a serious medical situation like that. This is a way to ban all abortions in Ohio and not allow the exceptions that the U.S. Supreme Court has always required.
Is there any legal doctrine here? I mean, can you vault ahead of the Roe v. Wade formula for determining when an abortion is legal or not by accepting this heartbeat equals American citizen kind of notion that comes in this bill? If you can hear a heartbeat, we're already basically outside of the Roe v. Wade timetable.
As a lawyer, we don't use Roe v. Wade anymore. The only people that talk about Roe v. Wade are politicians and anti-abortion activists. The law has advanced, and it's really viability. If a pregnancy is viable, then there cannot be an abortion. That's been the law in Ohio for a very long time. This bill is not tackling the issue of viability, because Ohio already has those bills in place. This is really prohibiting abortion outright.
By equating viability with heartbeat?
Well, by equating a heartbeat with the ban. If the heartbeat is not going to be heard until 6 weeks, and as soon as 6 weeks occurs, there's a heartbeat, now that means that in a practical sense, a woman doesn't even know she's pregnant. Because, you know, there's a four-week cycle. At 4 weeks, hey, I didn't get my period. Now what? Well, maybe you wait a couple of days, and then you take a pregnancy test, and then you call the clinic and ask to have an appointment. It's already going to be too late because you have to wait. And abortion providers aren't going to be able to stay providing these services if they're only going to be doing abortions for a two-week window.
Jennifer Branch is an attorney at Gerhardstein and Branch, a firm representing abortion providers in Ohio. Grammy Award-winning pianist Robert Glasper is the mad scientist at the center of the Robert Glasper experiment. For years, making a living as a jazz musician has been tough, but artistically, these are great times with the convergence of world musical styles and artists and the interest of pop musicians in the richness of jazz. And Robert Glasper is thrilled to be at the center of it all. His latest album is called Art Science. He says it's a musical mutt, the product of the intense mixing that can only come when you leave the world and spend 2 weeks camped out in a studio with your bandmates.
I told them, don't worry about genre, don't worry about vibe, don't worry about what it's supposed to sound like, how it's going to fit with the next song. Everybody just write songs. And we would write songs separately, and then we would finish each other's sentences and write songs collectively and do all these things, and it became an album sound that I have never heard, you know. Definitely some pop influence in there, some R&B influence, some hip-hop influence, some trap influence, definitely some 80s.
I listened to it, and, you know, it's like Esperanza Spalding's new album is like this Hendrix, Prince kind of hip-hop jazz thing. I mean, it's really wide, wide net.
Totally. And I grew up with a wide net, with that eclectic musical library. My mom was a musician and singer, and she loved all kinds of music, you know. So I got hip to all kinds of music at an early age. That kind of just started from there.
Back in the 70s and 80s, I mean, you were either a bebop guy or you were like a fusion guy. Mm-hmm. And it's just, there was no real intersection.
Right.
And I always felt that some of the stuff that Weather Report was trying to do was really great, but people were just either trying to commercialize them. And Zawinul, as often as they can, Pastorius is a very troubled fellow. But it feels like that whole spirit is back.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
But it's more connected to the people.
Exactly. That's a very good observation. That's exactly what the vibe is, kind of. I never looked at it that way, but I even looked at it in a kind of a Steely Danny kind of way, you know what I mean, where it is connected to a few more things But that's kind of the vibe I take away from it.
Can you perform this stuff?
Yeah. It was great.
Yeah.
It went really good. Yeah. And I, you know, we added some instruments to the band because on the album we actually added a guitar player. And we don't normally have guitar in our band, but I wanted a different sound, a different color on this record. So we added a guitar player to the band. So he actually did the show with us. My guitar player and my Mike Severson and my DJ, Jahi Sundance, they both did it with us. So it was great having those extra colors and vibes.
How do you write for that kind of an ensemble?
Well, for my DJ, the good thing about Jahi is, his dad, he comes from a jazz background. His dad's Oliver Lake. And Jahi also played saxophone in high school and stuff. So he's very, very in touch with the music in more ways than the average DJ is. So I love Jahi because when I have him there, he either just adds soundscape stuff, like mm-hmm. he'll add like a train sound or the sound of wind, you know, just mm-hmm. stuff that fits in the space where it doesn't overtake it, but it just fits in there. He's not over there scratching all day. I'm not a big scratch guy, you know, or he'll add somebody saying some poetry or just add somebody saying something that has something to do with the song we're doing, you know, and he'll do it. And without us having to talk, he'll just feel a moment and jump in the moment. And that's what I love about him. And it's different every night. You know what I mean? He'll just feel the moment, jump in the moment. I never like to know exactly what's going to happen. I get bored.
Well,
you know what I mean?
You so, can't be an improviser.
Yeah, exactly. So I love having loose ends, like not sure how we're going to start the tune, not sure how we're going to end it. I love that because it lends itself to stumbling across something cool, you know.
Big rack of keyboards or just a regular piano?
I have three keyboards. You know, I use two keyboards and a Rhodes. That's pretty much it. And then Casey Benjamin, my guy who plays the vocoder and the saxophone and all that, he has this big rack of stuff. I don't even know what you call it, but he has a plethora of sounds. So I love mixing, you know, the electronic sound with, I love acoustic piano. So one of my keyboards just stays on acoustic piano mm-hmm. sound. I love the sound of just the raw acoustic piano and the Rhodes rubbing up against a bunch of electronic sounds and stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, I like that mixture.
What's your grand ambition that everybody tells you no?
My grand ambition that everybody tells me no.
Yeah.
My band they don't let me rap.
Really?
Yeah, they don't let me rap on stage. As soon as I start rapping, the band just drops out. They literally stop playing. And so one of my ambitions is to actually be able to kick a rhyme or two on stage and feel confident in it, you know?
Yeah.
Because my band's not, they don't have my back. I don't feel so confident. And you start looking at me and be like, he's not confident anymore. Now I'm rhyming a cappella. There's no beat behind me and it gets weird.
Well, tell me, what track?
Maybe No One Like You. No One Like You is a song, that I started writing, and then I had Casey help me with some of the lyrics. He's a very good lyricist.
I've been searching for a long time, and I can't find no one like you. I've been searching for a long time, and I can't find no one like you.
It's kind of influenced by Sting, The Police, without even realizing it until after I did it. And I was like, wait a minute, this sounds like something Sting would do. And not to mention, when I was at the White House, I had just got to hang out with Sting there for a while, actually. We were all in this room, and me and Sting and Pat Metheny we got a chance to just kick it for like an hour, just us.
What's that?
It was really cool, yeah.
That is really cool.
And so maybe from that, you know, it made me write that. I don't know. I love that song, and I feel like it encompasses who we are as a band, you know, because we take solos on the song, and it kind of goes different directions, but it has this, like, Police 80s feel that I love. I love the 80s. I love 80s music. I think it's my favorite era of music, which is why we did Human as well, you know, Humanly.
I'm only human, a flesh and blood, a man.
Actually, funny thing, when I did Human, and when the album came out, Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis were the producers of Human, for the Human League. They produced the song. The day the album came out, or the next day, Jimmy Jam tweeted me and said, I love your version of Human.
So many times I looked and saw your face.
added Human League on the tweet, and that made my day. That was the highlight of me doing that album, to have Jimmy Jam tweet me and say he loved what we did with it.
Robert Glasper is a jazz pianist behind the Robert Glasper Experiment. His latest album, Art Science, is out now. For Americans of a certain generation, a turning point in television history and the first moment when African Americans and white Americans could genuinely find a shared history together came with the broadcast of the TV miniseries in 1977 called Roots on ABC.
Papa wants to get back to masses. Don't want to run into any patrollers after it gets dark.
Kizzy, don't you want to be my slave? Aren't you my friend?
Of course I'm your friend, Missy Ann. I just has to ask my mama and my papa.
That's Leslie Uggams as Kizzy Reynolds in Roots and Sandy Duncan playing Missy Ann Reynolds. Uggams has been there for a lot of turning points in the entertainment business, a performer since the age of six. Uggams is a cultural pioneer, winning a Tony Award for her Broadway debut in Hallelujah Baby and becoming the first African-American woman to host her own TV variety show way back in 1970. Today, Uggams stays busy and relevant with roles including the hip-hop television drama Empire and this year's hit comic book movie Deadpool. Now, there's a range. Uggams spoke with Takeaway producer Dana Roberson about how it was that 1977 series Roots that collectively turned Americans inward to their own history, seeking answers to the basic question of how we all live together.
Well, it was the first time that America got exposed for the history. Everything had been hush-hush because it certainly wasn't in the history books. And Alex Haley wrote this incredible book about searching his roots and this journey from Africa to America and how we were treated. And people were just riveted because they had never seen anything like this before. And that's why every night people were glued to the television. And that's why it got such huge ratings, because people were like shocked.
Yeah, I don't think anyone did anything else but watch that series.
Well, also remember there was only three networks. So therefore, we didn't have to compete with cable. And you better watch it if you wanted to see it. And, I mean, it was like the stars were aligned. There was a big blizzard in the east, so people were kind of shut in. So everything worked for the show, and including the head of ABC, who decided he didn't think much of it. And so he wanted to get rid of it, and he put it on every night, which made him a hero because it became the miniseries, and he got all the credit for that. But it was just a special experience.
What was it like personally playing the role of Kizzy?
Well, Kizzy, I carry her still in my heart, because she, through terrible, terrible circumstances, still managed to keep her head above water and to bring up the son and make sure that he carried the tradition that she had gotten from her father, which was keep telling the stories about where you came from, pass it on, pass it on, pass it on. And she was an extraordinary, strong character to play.
Does our generation sort of have that desire or knowledge that it's important to pass information on, do you think, the younger generation today?
Well, you got the iPod and the iPad and the I this and the I that. I mean, information has become sound bites, unfortunately. I don't know how many sit down with their parents or their grandparents and really ask them about their history. They should. When I was growing up, I didn't get much information from my grandmother because they were ashamed of, you know, being born slaves and living on plantations, and it was a kind of horror story, so they didn't want to share that. But I think it's very important now for parents who, you know, you have children, to tell your stories.
Was your grandmother still living when Roots came out?
No, unfortunately, she had passed away, because I know she would have loved it. She would have loved it, because she was one of 10 children, and her mother had children by the plantation owner. But he built a house for them and a school on the property. It's quite an amazing story, the Boyds. And they were well educated and they became dentists and doctors and teachers, and it's amazing.
They have come out recently with a recent updated roots. Opinions varied on whether it stood the test of time. I think the original roots stands the test of time. But there's been a lot of sort of a resurgence of these sort of slave narrative movies, series that have been coming out. Do you think it's important that we continue to tell slave narratives, or should we move past those times?
Well, I think we need to start talking about the modern times. I mean, there's been great people in our history who have made great contributions, and you know, we've seen the slavery situation, and I think it's time to move on and do something new, because we certainly have great people in history that we could make movies about, and that's what we need to do. It's not easy, you know. It's kind of, I guess, easier when you see black people in conflict and that, you know, that kind of thing. Oh, that makes a great movie. But I think it's time to move on.
Speaking of moving on, Deadpool.
Yes, that was me.
Blind Al, what was that like?
Oh, awesome. Just absolutely awesome. I had such a great time. I love Ryan Reynolds and Tim Miller, who directed it. And I just love the character. She's feisty, and they have a great relationship. It's kind of like a love-hate relationship. And they're both together, funny as hell.
It's great to mix it up, too.
Yes.
You know, challenge yourself.
Absolutely.
In different roles and comedy and serious roles. And it's certainly a far cry from Kizzy.
Oh, yes.
And Empire.
Yes. I love that character and Leah Walker. And people have really taken to her. She's scary. She's cuckoo, cuckoo. So you never know what she's going to do. But people really have. They're enjoying her tremendously. And I love the fact that it also gives the character of Lucius, you really understand where he's coming from. Because even though he's been flashback with his rapping, telling his story and everything, to see the dynamic now between him and his mother right there in the flesh, who was supposed to be dead.
But she wasn't.
But she wasn't.
And now she's there.
Yes. It makes it his character even more powerful, I think.
So what's next? What's next for you?
I never know. Quite honestly, I never know. You know, my mother used to say to me, you look around one corner and it comes around the other. So I'm looking, and who knows?
Great. Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
And an honor. Thank you.
Bye.
Speaking with The Takeaway is Dana Robeson, and Leslie Uggams is a Tony and Emmy Award-winning actress and singer.
Hi, I'm calling regarding how we see ourselves reflected in certain TV and movie roles. And Good Girls Revolt on Amazon Prime is a great female-led series. It's the first show I've seen in a while that shows strong, educated females, and I hope it sticks around.
Do you see yourself in pop culture? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Rest in peace, Greg Lake, from one 21st century schizoid man to another. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, with a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, training programs that draw from 50 brain games, and tools to compare scores with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And American Express. American Express has cards and services designed for businesses of all sizes. Learn more at Open.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
RI, Public Radio International.